that Daryl is handing out is not necessarily something you might want to give your students. You could. It's more for you. And tomorrow when we come to class, I'll read the answers. But I really would like if you would do this work yourself. Don't talk to your friends or relatives or teachers or even consult an atlas or a dictionary. I just like to know where you are. Okay? We did this one time for... Okay, how many more do we need? Put your hands up if you need one yet. About 20. We need about 20 more copies. We did this at a Michiana teachers thing, and the results were interesting. So this is just a check to see about you. Okay, and if you're interested in that kind of thing, here's another thing that I don't know how many are interested. You don't have to do this, but I have several copies up here of multiple intelligence survey. If you're curious about the various kinds of intelligences, there's a way you can measure yourself as to your, they have nine of them, naturalistic intelligence, your musical, logical, existential, your interpersonal, kinesthetic, verbal, intrapersonal, and visual. If you're interested, you may come and get one from me afterwards. Okay, having said all that, the routine of surprise. I need to tell you right up front that I'm teaching this out of my context. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got, I was a new teacher. I taught 1 year, and in our community, there was an old man who had taught 47 years. And I said, what advice do you have for a new teacher? And he said two words that I've never forgotten, and it's extremely important advice. Be yourself. Now, I'm going to be teaching you about the routine of surprise out of my context. But I'm not you, and you're not me. So, I would like you to think in terms of adapting what I say to your own settings. You be you. What comes to you? In fact, in this today and tomorrow, you may not even need to take notes. You may if you want to. But I want you to experience some things. I'm not going to tell you how. I want to show you some things. You know, I just told the last class that one of the major jobs of a teacher is to enlarge the horizons of your little student's world. How many of you are teaching right now in a large Anabaptist community somewhere? Raise your hands. Okay. Those of you with your hands right now, this is majorly important for you. I taught in Texas for many years, and now I'm teaching in northern Indiana, and I have to say that people who live in large Anabaptist communities' horizons are about this big. Your job is to stretch them. And a warning, they don't like it stretched. It's scary. It does things to them. That's really beside the point. Your job is to introduce them to new things. Make them think about new things, whether they feel like it or not. That's a major job that you have. Okay. Without explaining, I'm just going to read you a story. The first time I heard him teach, I said to myself, I want to study under that man. His name was Howard G. Hendricks, and I entered seminary to learn everything I could from this master teacher. I wanted to learn not only what he taught, but also how he taught. During my 4 years of graduate study, I listened to Dr. Hendricks for more than 350 hours and always left his class instructed, challenged, and a step closer to God. By the time I was a senior, I began to wonder if Prof even understood the word boring. After studying how he taught for 4 years, I discovered he followed a basic style. About 3 minutes before class began, his right foot began to bounce underneath an old desk. At the precise moment the second hand swept past 12, he raised his right forefinger into the air, announced, "Ladies and gentlemen," and delivered an opening one-liner that was so stimulating, all of us couldn't help but copy it down. About 3 to 4 minutes, he told his first joke. 8 to 10 minutes into the class, he would inevitably rise from his desk and draw a graph or chart on the whiteboard, always the blue pen first, and draw a graph or chart, and then the purple, and always with that unique squiggly underline for emphasis. His rhythm was unmistakable, and it worked. Just ask any of the thousands who have studied under him. During my last year of seminary, I decided to give Dr. Hendricks a test. I wanted to see what this master teacher would do if one of his students would not, no matter what, pay attention in his class. I sat in the back right-hand corner of the room next to the only window and decided to gaze out that window the entire class session. Since there were only 30 students in the class, he was sure to notice. I took off my watch and started timing. What would he do if he couldn't get my attention? As I expected, he started off with a bang and delivered his usual one-liner. Although my hand began to tremble, I forced myself not to record the line. From the corner of my eye, I could see that he noticed immediately that I wasn't paying attention. He broke tradition and in the first minute told a joke, totally out of context. If I laughed, he would immediately know I was listening. So I discreetly put my hand over my mouth and continued staring out the window. As the 2-minute mark passed, he got up from his chair and started drawing on the board much too early. He again noticed that I wasn't taking notes, and he stopped right in the middle of his chart and didn't even finish it. He put the pen down and walked to the corner of the room in order to look down the aisle at me, trying to make eye contact. Sweat beaded on my brow. But the seconds continued ticking by. I wasn't going to pay attention. Finally, he broke. The master teacher almost leaped down the aisle and yelled, "Wilkerson, what on earth are you looking at outside that window?" With a sheepish glance, I turned around and said, "Nothing, Prof. Sorry." I looked down at my watch to determine his grade. Only 3 minutes and 37 seconds had passed. Incredible. His tolerance for one student not paying attention was limited to 217 seconds. With that remarkable experience freshly imprinted on my mind, I walked down the hall into the next class with a different professor. Talk about a contrast. On the one side of the room was filled by students who never paid attention but did their homework for another class. This teacher, however, didn't seem bothered. He just turned and lectured to the students sitting on the other side. His mindset was, "It's not my problem if you don't want to learn." What a difference. One teacher could tolerate for only a few seconds one student not learning what he was teaching, and the other didn't seem to care for the whole semester. Dr. Hendricks believed that, as a teacher, he was the one responsible for my learning. By contrast, the second teacher thought he was responsible only to cover the material, regardless of whether anyone learned. Folks, teachers, it's our job to cause students to learn. And the routine of surprise, I'm going to suggest, is a way to do that. We don't need any lights out yet on this one. There's the routine of surprise. Which is the stronger word? A little feedback here. Is the word routine stronger or surprise stronger? Someone talk to me. It's okay if you're wrong. Again?
Surprise.
No. Think about the noun. If I was doing a diagram on that, wouldn't it be routine here and of surprise under it? Right? I think so. I'm sorry, I was too blunt with you. I apologize. But routine is a stronger word there. Now take a look at this. Does this mean that it's good for a teacher to be unpredictably predictable or predictably unpredictable? Now think about what I just taught you in relation to routine and surprise. Anybody have a comment? Yes. You think it's better to do this one. Okay, which is the stronger word, the noun or the adjective?
The
the noun is stronger. I would like to suggest to you that this is the better. Predictable, but we're unpredictably predictable. See, here we're talking about routine of surprise. You cannot have school unless you have routine, right? But you've got to keep breaking that routine up with surprise if you're going to have students that learn. And that's what we mean by this, unpredictably predictable. Okay. While you have your heads thinking, look at this. And again, it's okay if you're wrong. It just doesn't matter if you're wrong. You learn by mistakes. If we have these three words together, American, Mennonite, and Christian, how would you put those three together in one line? Is it better to say you're a Mennonite American, Christian American, a Christian American Mennonite, or an American Mennonite Christian? Thank you. This little girl has learned that we go with the strongest word first. I hope you're Christian first. I think your theology is Mennonite, and I do think you live in America, right? Now, you could interchange this. You could say you're a Mennonite American Christian, too. You could do that. But you want to make sure this is the strongest one here. Okay? Now, my objective in these two classes is to convince you or to share with you that the learning process happens when students' minds are 100% engaged. And a routine of surprise is a wonderful way to keep minds engaged. And so I have a question for you. Does a person learn when he's sleeping? Yes or no? Say it. It's okay if you're wrong. That's not the answer I was looking for. I guess you can learn some things. I hear people say that if you play tapes or CDs while you're sleeping, it actually goes in. I'm not really thinking about technical things like that. If you had a student in class and he's sleeping, would you just say, okay, you can learn while you sleep? I don't think so. Okay, does a person learn when he's half sleeping? I don't think so. What about being awake but passive? Yawning, looking at the clock. Is he learning? Not too much. If a student is mildly interested, or coming, what about eager to learn? Mm-hmm. What about passionate about learning? Mm-hmm. That's where learning happens. And so this morning we're going to be focusing on routine surprises. We're not talking about large unexpected surprises like a sudden field trip or a student breaking an arm or a school board member showing up unexpectedly. One day when I was in Texas, I don't know if Dolores was in my class or not, I was having a math class and suddenly we heard all these big heavy sounds and we looked out and there was one of these big Chinook helicopters landing in the field right beside our school. That was time for an impromptu field trip. We just had to lay the math down and go visit this Chinook helicopter. In fact, it crash landed. It had a problem with the engine. It had to come down. And another one was flying with it. It landed beside it. And we went down to talk, and those men gave us an impromptu field trip, opened up the helicopter. We could walk right in. Now, that doesn't happen every day, but that did happen. Okay, and you can imagine, none of us were half sleeping when we were in a helicopter either. We were all wide open. Wow, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Okay, now, a lot of what I'm going to share with you, scattered throughout here, comes from my experience and what I bump into. And I take the World Magazine, and I know that you could argue with me about that, but I use it as a teaching tool. So if I could have some lights out now, I would like to do some things. When I get the World Magazine, I read through it, and I often take it to school, and then I share things like this. First of all, who's this guy? Someone say, I can't even see you out there very well. Who is it? Look at him. Who?
Harry Truman.
Harry Truman. Okay. For the president who famously said, the buck stops here, The final buck has at long last been paid. The Harry S. Truman Library Institute has finally paid an 80-year-old former paperboy who was stiffed by the Trumans on his paper route 65 years ago. This guy, George Lund, with a Truman impersonator, by the way, that's not really Harry Truman, said he recently received payment from the Truman Library Institute, making good on a decades-old $7.50 bill owed to him in 1947 when the Truman's Kansas City, Missouri home was part of his Kansas City Independent Examiner paper route. Lund told KMBC that the Institute paid him not only the $7.50 bill, but also more than six decades of interest. What word pops into your head when you see that? Starts with an I. Say it. Integrity. Wow. Look at this. It's unlikely that any of Tyler Sullivan's teachers will quibble with his absence from school on June 1st. And by the way, that just happened just 2 months ago. The 11-year-old Minnesota student skipped school for the first time in his life to witness President Barack Obama speak at a Honeywell facility in Golden Valley, Minnesota, with his father, Ryan Sullivan. The elder Sullivan helped Tyler jostle his way to the front of the ranks prior to the speech, a move that paid off. As the president walked past, the fifth grader struck up a conversation with Obama. First I said, "Hi, Mr. President." Then he says, "Hi, Tyler. You must be out of school then," Tyler told ABC News. Then Obama had an aide bring him a marker and a White House stationery while he asked Tyler the name of his teacher. On it, the president wrote, "Please excuse Tyler. He was with me." Wow. If the president would come to your town, would you go? I hope you close your school down and go. President George Bush, before he was president, when he was governor of Texas, it was at my local town, and I regret to this day I was too busy with something else, and I didn't go. I missed the chance. This boy didn't. My wife loves this one. The getaway car for an early June robbery at a Houston bank was put to good use, but not by the robbers. A woman who identified herself to reporters as Blanca was cashing a check at the Chase Bank in Houston when the robbery began. Blanca says she was thinking about her children at home when she crouched and fled out the door, jumping into the first car she saw and speeding away. The car turned out to be the robber's getaway car, which helps explain why it was left unlocked and running. Blanca says she drove a few miles from the bank, pulled over, and ran into another store. Eventually, the Houston police arrived and arrested Blanca for car theft. But the FBI later cleared her and named her as a witness in the bank robbery. Students love stories like that. Okay, talk to me about that. That's a political cartoon. Talk to me. What's it saying? What doesn't work? What about that bus up on top of it? What is that? The Obama presidential campaign can't handle speed bumps like that. That's what it's saying. Good. You know, when you show this to students, they might just laugh at the picture, but political cartoons are written for a reason. And so sometimes you have to help them a little bit with the reason. Can anybody explain what's going on here? Who's the fellow at the desk? Who? No, I don't think so in this case. Look at him. Who? I think so. It's the Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Roberts. Who is the lady down below? Nancy Pelosi. Okay. John Roberts says, "I had to rewrite your paper, Nancy, but it passed. Look what he gave it, an Affordable Care Act, D-. But what does she say? She doesn't know. Can anybody make a comment? What's being communicated by that picture?
We have to pass this so we know what's in it.
Yeah, and you don't know what's in it. Do you think it might be good for everybody? So many pages, it ought to be good for everybody, right? Is it going to be good for anybody? He gives it a D minus and she doesn't know what's in it. Do you think it might be good for everybody? I don't. I don't think so. Okay? Anybody have any idea what's going on in that picture? High speed rail. What's rope to the tracks? Does anybody know what they're thinking about in California right now? Exactly. Think that cartoon is blessing the idea? No. Okay, what does this cartoon say? What's the message? If you look, what's written on the eraser? Could you see it? Anybody in the front row, what's it say on the eraser?
Obama.
It says Obama. Obama is erasing the border with Arizona and Mexico. What's the message? This is a huge political issue. What is the bigger issue? Okay, there's a lot of people in this country who do not want immigrants to come in. And so Arizona passed a strong law to keep immigrants out. And most of those immigrants were coming from Spanish-American countries. But Obama has not agreed to uphold Arizona's laws. And so he's erasing the line, which basically says we may have more immigrants come in from Mexico. That's what that's saying. Okay, anybody interpret this last one? What's going on? Okay, what does the elephant stand for?
Republicans,
okay. So what did the Republicans say? What did you say again? Okay. I think maybe there's another message there too. Exactly. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, right now is getting a lot of flack for not being conservative and in rejecting Obamacare. And so, who appointed John Roberts?
George Bush.
Okay. Now, when we talk about all these kind of things, see, it brings a lot of current events into the picture. It's one thing to hear about current events, but it's another thing to interpret them. And so exercise like this just helps interpret current events. And it's a perfect opportunity to give a Christian worldview, to teach worldview while you're doing things like that. Okay, now I'm going to give you several quotes. And you don't even have to write these down, but I want you to pay attention to what they say. We're thinking about the routine of surprise. Learning happens when a student encounters something surprising or unexpected. Learning happens when a student encounters something surprising or unexpected. I wasn't watching you while I was talking here, but I doubt whether anybody was really sleeping or even half asleep while we were interpreting these political cartoons. So I'm saying by that, you're probably learning, because you're probably delighted with what you're seeing. Secondly, delight results from the combination of surprise and joy. And this is what political cartoons do. They surprise and you enjoy. The students almost always laugh at a political cartoon. Now, a negative attitude created with surprise and anger, I'm sorry, if you have surprise with anger, it creates a negative attitude. So it's the opposite. Learning from surprises and unexpected situations is a capacity that is critical for developmental learning. Okay, let's go into some more of these. I don't know if you can see that, but that man is carving Mount Rushmore. And he's carving it into cheddar cheese. Some artists use canvas, others marble. Wisconsin's Troy Landwehr specializes in cheese. Called by some the nation's foremost and only cheese artist, Landwehr crafted a 640-pound block of mild cheddar cheese into a likeness of Mount Rushmore for the lobby of the West Palm Beach, Florida City Hall for the 4th of July. The title of the work? My Country, Tis of Cheese. Landwehr also decided to donate all the chipped off chunks of his sculpture to The Lord's Place, a local charity that feeds the homeless. We're expecting, said The Lord's Place Robert Coleman, to be getting about 150 to 200 pounds of cheese in various chunks. Human interest. They love that kind of thing. If you'd ask them if they'd like to have a piece of that cheddar, of course they would. This is an amazing picture. You know, I could just read it better looking up here. San Diego charge. Residents of San Diego who showed up for the well-known Big Bay Boom July 4 fireworks show certainly got a big show, but it lasted only 15 seconds instead of the scheduled 18 minutes. A technical malfunction meant the show began and ended simultaneously, with the entire fireworks program being set off at the same time. The result was spectacular and spectacularly short. So that's what it looks like when all the fireworks go off together. Off the rails. If you're wondering what happens when you turn a four-year-old loose on the internet, one New Zealand mother has the answer. He attempts to buy a $25,000 train. In June, one Kiwi mother identified only by her online name accidentally left her accounts on a New Zealand auction site up. That's when her four-year-old son got on the computer and began clicking around. Eventually, the child landed on a listing selling an old, dilapidated electric passenger train. And somehow, the youngster managed to place a winning bid on the relic for $25,000. After a frantic email by the mother, the boy's bid was removed, and on July 2, a real buyer was found. A happy accident. Okay, this is kind of a cut and paste. You can see some things that aren't complete here, but Taco Tsunami. When residents of Bethel, Alaska realized the flyers announcing the opening of a Taco Bell in their remote town of about $6,000 were a hoax, their elation quickly turned to despair. Residents in the tiny and difficult-to-reach town know fast food from cable television ads, but because of the town's place in the far west of the already remote state, they've never had a fast food restaurant. But executives at Taco Bell, who heard about the hoax, decided to arrange for a one-time feast for town residents. On July 1st, Taco Bell executives arranged for 10,000 tacos to be flown from Anchorage, Alaska, the nearest Taco Bell location, 400 miles west of Bethel. Even better, the fast food chain picked up the bill. Isn't that neat? I wanted to include this lady's story, but this lady pretended she had some kind of physical condition that didn't allow her to work while she was holding down two full-time jobs. And she was collecting unemployment or, you know, charity money from the government until they caught her. And now she has, she's convicted of 7 counts of fraud. Wouldn't you like your name and picture to be on something like that? Nate Saint, son of slain missionary Nate Saint, suffered a paralyzing injury while testing new technology at Indigenous Peoples Technology and Education Ministry Center, a ministry he founded to develop products to help spread their gospel in remote parts of the world. Saint, 61, who after the July 13 accident could only slightly raise his arms, was able to stand briefly with support after surgery June 19 to relieve pressure on his spine. Saint's passion for aviation and missions culminated in recent years with a Maverick flying car that enables missionaries to travel up to 90 miles per hour on paved roads, handle off-road conditions, or fly the skies when roads end. And there you can see his car. Wow, that grabs students' attentions and imaginations. Lobster boat captain Bobby Stoddard of Clark's Harbor, Nova Scotia, had heard of blue lobsters, but he'd never seen one until early May when he heard one of his men say, "Hey, we got a pretty one in this trap." The lobster in the trap turned out to be an example of the one out of 2 million lobsters with a genetic variation that turns it blue. Stoddard is reportedly trying to decide what to do with the lobster after an ocean research incident wasn't interested in the find. He told CNN, "It probably belongs back in the ocean, but I'd like for as many people as possible to see it." slowed down. This is an incredible one. If the state police didn't eventually get him, it's likely the road rash would have. Authorities in upstate New York finally apprehended a motorcyclist who they say had been making a habit of blowing past speed traps at super high speeds. On May 30, an officer with the state police allegedly clocked Poughkeepsie, New York resident Anthony Anderson going 193 miles per hour on his motorcycle in the midst of a rain shower. Other officers eventually spotted and arrested the 28-year-old in Rosendale, New York, and issued him 14 traffic tickets. Now, if you give that in class, automatically the boys will start talking. Automatically. And you don't even have to be very moralistic about the lesson you learn from that. You might talk about hydroplaning a little bit. Perfect 10. Whatever they're doing at University High School in Irvine, California seems to be working. After receiving back standardized testing grades in June, school officials learned that 10 of their students received a perfect 36 score on the ACT College Aptitude Exam. According to ACT officials, it's the first time any school has managed to rack up 10 perfect scores in the same year. When you check achievement tests, you ever have perfect parts? It's a pleasure when you do. I've never even come close to that. Okay, when do you do this? I think it's pretty obvious that some of this kind of stuff is valuable. When do you do it? Again, I'm just telling you how I do it. And if you want to do it something different in your classroom, that's just fine. But I would like to do something like this. It's a goal for me to have this, something like this. Something, not exactly what I'm doing. We have 2 days to show you different kinds of things to do. But something, at least once a day. Somewhere. And for me, it's usually after devotions are over and we have our Bible memory set, before we start math. There's a window right there where I like to do this stuff before everybody gets busy with their own things. And we just spend, 15 minutes or whatever. I'm doing a whole pile of them. And so I don't want you to think that you ought to go to school at all and just do this all day. You're probably going to get overloaded with all this stuff. But please understand, we're only doing this at slots, 10, 15 minutes per day. Okay, back to another few quotes. A classroom should celebrate and nurture surprises. Surprise needs to be a part of teaching because it's part of learning itself. Surprise fuels both lifelong learners and lifelong teachers. And I would say amen to that because it fuels my teaching. I don't know what I would do. I don't know. I would burn out, I guess. But I look forward to stuff, and I constantly collect stuff to take to my school to share with the students, like this, for surprises. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I had some experiences this summer. I can hardly wait to get back to my school to tell my students. Surprises. Things that they can learn from. Okay? I think this came from World Magazine. You might have even have seen this. Now if I can get that on there. If you can put those both together. That will make them chatter. You don't have to say a thing, but they will chatter. All right. May I have some lights, please? I feel it is one of my duties every year to read this. And Dolores is one of my students, and she's probably heard this several times. But it's the bells. How many of you know what I'm going to read before I even read it? Bless your hearts. Good for you. This is the best poem in the English language for sound. And I'm not even professing to do it the very best way. But sometime before we start math, or sometime we're reading, something in our schedule bumps into Edgar Allan Poe or the bells or onomatopoeia or something, get this poem out. This is what it sounds like. And by the way, you need to listen for four stages of life. The first stage of life is childhood. The second is marriage. The third is midlife in the heat of the day. And the fourth stage is death. So listen for those four stages. Hear the sledges with the bells, silver bells. What a world of merriment their melody foretells. How they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night, while the stars that oversprinkle all the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight, keeping time, time, time in a sort of runic rhyme to the tintinnabulation that so musically wells from the bells, 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 from the jingling and the tinkling of the bells. Hear the mellow wedding bells, golden bells. What a world of happiness their harmony foretells. Through the balmy air of night, how they ring out their delight from the molten golden notes and all in tune. What a liquid ditty floats to the turtle dove that listens while she gloats on the moon. All from out the sounding cells, what a gush of euphony voluminously wells. How it swells, how it dwells on the future, how it tells of the rapture that impels to the swinging and the ringing of the bells, 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 of the bells, 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 to the rhyming and the chiming of the bells. Hear the loud alarum bells, brazen bells. What a tale of terror now their turbulency tells. In the startled ear of night, how they scream out their affright, too much horrified to speak. They can only shriek, shriek, out of tune, in a clamorous appealing to the mercy of the fire, in a mad expostulation with the deaf and frantic fire, leaping higher, 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 with a desperate desire and a resolute endeavor, now, now to sit or never by the side of the pale-faced moon. Oh, the bells, 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 what a tale their terror tells of despair. How they clang and clash and roar. What a horror they outpour on the bosom of the palpitating air. Yet the ear it fully knows by the twanging and the clanging how the danger ebbs and flows. Yet the ear distinctly tells in the jangling and the wrangling how the danger sink and swells by the sinking or the swelling in the anger of the bells, of the bells, of the bells, 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 in the clamor and the clangor of the bells. Hear the tolling of the bells, iron bells. What a world of solemn thought their monody compels. In the silence of the night, how we shiver with affright at the melancholy menace of their tone. For every sound that floats from the rust within their throats is a groan. And the people, ah, the people, they that dwell up in the steeple all alone, and who tolling, tolling, tolling in that muffled monotone feel a glory and so rolling on the human heart a stone. They are neither man nor woman. They are neither brute nor human. They are goals. And their king it is who tolls. And he rolls, 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 rolls a paean from the bells. And his merry bosom swells with the paean of the bells. And he dances and he yells, keeping time, time, time in a sort of runic rhyme to the paean of the bells, keeping time, time, time in a sort of runic rhyme to the throbbing of the bells, 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 to the sobbing of the bells, keeping time, 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 as he knells, 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 in a happy runic rhyme, to the rolling of the bells, 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 to the tolling of the bells, 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 to the moaning and the groaning of the bells. Don't answer me. But did that do anything for you? There's only one poem like that. Time is soon up. I love posters. If any one of you want to buy posters, Ken's Joys near Myerstown, Pennsylvania. No, it's on 322 east of Ephrata. If you want to buy posters, that's a wonderful place to buy posters. Okay, I'll put this up in my classroom. I just got this this summer. What's that say? Talk to me.
Life is interesting.
It's interesting. Keep talking. That's a good thought.
You don't know what's coming.
We don't know what's coming.
Brave the ups and downs.
Brave the ups and downs. I like this.
See what's around the next curve.
Again?
See what's around the next curve.
What's around the next curve? When little boys and girls look out on life, is everything going to be happy hereafter in their little minds? They know it's not, but this simply helps reinforce that life is not a happily ever after deal. Life has its curves and its twists unexpectedly. It's a life lesson. What's this? I like to put that in my classroom too. What is that? It's a lobster. Now, as soon as I see this, then I need to tell them a story. Because this summer when I was in Ireland, the people, one of the occupations in Ireland is fishing. And so right near where my son is a fishing port where they have lobster boats. And so one day, I decided I'm going down. There's a lady in their church who is a sister to one of these lobstermen. And I went to this man and I said, may I go out with you and just tend your lobster pots that day? Just experience lobstering. He says, well, you know, we have insurance problems. And, you know, I know that. So he wrote up a paper that absolved him of any financial responsibility if the boat sank and I drowned. You know, I would not sue him. And he took me out. Or my wife wouldn't sue him. Okay, so he told me where to stand. He had this little boat. He told me where to stand, so I'm out of his way. And there we pulled up lobster pots. And the clock would not let me tell you all the stories of what it's like to pull up lobster pots. I did not see any blue lobsters. But I did see lots of these. And not only lobsters get into lobster pots. This is what also crawls into lobster pots. What is this? Octopus. Now, I've learned about octopuses before, but I've never had one that I pulled out of a trap and was on my arms with its tentacles like that, just wrapping themselves around my arm. You know, with their tentacles stretched out from one side to the other like that. They have this big-looking head with an eye like that. And they have these little suction cups, you know, that are working, and then they actually do suck and so on. But if we got into a contest, there was no question that we were going to win, okay? So it wasn't threatening. But what I didn't realize, I knew that when lobsters need to get away, they use jet propulsion. Would one of you mind telling me how it works?
A tooth.
Tube. Okay, then what? Okay, you see this big bulge right here? Well, if you look real carefully, you see that little space right there? That's a hole. They bring water, fill up this whole thing back here with water, and then they just collapse this whole thing right here, and water shoots out this way, and the octopus goes that way. And when we caught three of these things, all about the same size, big enough to crawl into a lobster pot. And the man, he didn't like to kill these things. I don't know. I should have. But he says, I'm going to throw one of these back. He said, now you watch. As soon as it hits the water, watch the ink that comes out. Because that's one of the things they do to protect themselves. They throw ink. The same time they go backwards, they put ink in the water so that whoever is right there can't find them anymore. They don't see where they go. So he did that one. The next one, he actually killed and stabbed and put in the lobster pot as bait. Usually lobsters, I mean, octopus try to eat lobsters. That's their meal. But this was backwards. He killed a lobster, put it in bait so that the lobsters can come in and eat the octopus. And the third one, I guess he just was merciful to octopuses. We caught it, and he threw it back in. And you can imagine, once they hit the water, it doesn't take long for them. They're right out of there. Now for you, you probably wouldn't even think about buying a lobster picture. But I had just gone to Ireland, and so this is extremely meaningful to me. So whatever is meaningful to you, whatever you're bumping into, get your pictures. That will help you tell a story to your boys and girls. Okay. Almost finished. Look at lights out real quickly. Have you ever seen this kind of stuff? Those four figures are all the same size? You've probably seen that. Here's one I had not seen before. Do you know that those tabletops are exactly the same length and exactly the same width? If you don't believe me, get a ruler and come up and check it. That seems impossible, doesn't it? Check me out. Here's something else to do. We all think about signatures. Here's some famous signatures from the past. If you, Rod and Staff's 8th grade history has a whole bunch more, 56 more of them. But there's George III's signature. And when George III went blind, that's what his signature looked like. You recognize any of those people? I like that one. Wow. Can you read that one? Who's that? John Hancock. On the Declaration of Independence, that signature is bigger than any others. Does anybody know what he said as soon as he signed that?
He wanted King George III to see it.
He says, now George III ought to be able to read that. Okay, this is the last one, then we're going to have to quit for today. I have a spelling checker. It came with my PC. It plainly marks for my review mistakes I cannot see. I strike a key and type a word and wait for it to say whether I am wrong or right. It shows me straight away. As soon as a mistake is made, it knows before too long, and I can put the error right. It's rarely ever wrong. I have run this poem through it. I am sure you're pleased to know it's letter perfect all the way. My checker told me so. Okay, lights on. Thank you for your attention. You're excused.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.